everyone. It's goodbye.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily via the internet address www.parstoday.com/en. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Intelsat 902, and Eutelsat satellite, as well as via internet. You can also listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for more details.
Here we enlighten you with ayahs 261 and 262 from the Surah Baqarah, recited by Ali Pariskar.
A'udhu billahi minash shaytanir rajeem. Bismillahir rahmanir rahim. مثل الذين ينفقون أموالهم في سبيل الله كمثل حبة أنبتت سبع سنابل كمثل حبة أنبتت سبع سنابل في كل سنبلة مئة حبة والله يضاعف لمن يشاء والله واسع عليم مثل الذين ينفقون أموالهم في سبيل الله كمثل حبة أنبتت سبع سنابل كمثل حبة أنبتت سبع سنابل في كل سنبلة مئة حبة والله يضاعف لمن يشاء والله واسع عليم الذين ينفقون أموالهم في سبيل الله ثم قوما ولا أنا ثم لا يتبعون ما أنفقوا منا ولا أذى لهم أجرهم عند ربهم ولا خوف عليهم ولا هم يحزنون صدق الله العلي العظيم.
In the name of God, the most gracious, the most compassionate. The parable of those who spend their property in the way of Allah is as the parable of the grain growing 7 years, with 100 grains in every year. And Allah multiplies for whom He pleases, and Allah is ample giving, knowing. As for those who spend their property in the way of Allah, then do not follow what they have spent with reproach or injury. They shall have their reward from their Lord, and they shall have no fear, nor shall they grieve.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
Iran rejects a claim by Britain, France and Germany that it is in breach of the 2015 nuclear deal, saying the trio have done nothing to honor their own obligations. Venezuela's president hails the UN's call for the lifting of the US and EU sanctions on the Latin American country, while the opposition blasts the report. Also ahead, the new U.S. administration repeats former President Barack Obama's campaign promise to close the notorious Guantanamo Bay prison. Thank you for joining us. Our top story, Iran's Foreign Minister Mohammad Javad Zarif has rejected a claim by Britain, France and Germany that Tehran is in breach of the 2015 nuclear deal. Zarif said Iran's activities are in line with paragraph 36 of the nuclear deal. He added that the three European signatories, or E3, have done nothing to fulfill their obligations following the US withdrawal in 2018. Zarif was reacting to a statement by the European signatories in which they called on Iran to halt producing uranium metal. The E3 also urged Tehran not to take any non-compliant steps. After Washington's pullout of the deal, the Europeans had pledged to take steps to compensate for the loss and facilitate money transactions. The E3 have taken no serious measures in this regard nearly 3 years after the US's withdrawal and its unilateral sanctions against Iran. Political commentator Tawhid Asadi says the European signatories to the Iran nuclear deal are following the policy dictated to them by the United States.
Well, I think the recent accusations we have heard from the European countries is the same trajectory that they have been following over the past 5 years. And we know that after JCPOA was signed and sealed as a Security Council resolution, we have received almost nothing from the European Union except for some verbal statements and some, let's say, lack of commitment. When it comes to European Union and European signatories of the deal, of course, they are basically following the same foreign policy trajectory and the same foreign policy, let's say, behavior that has been dictated by the United States to them. And this is something that Iran could not maybe tolerate anymore. Well, we know that from 2015, up until the moment that we're talking, patience is the name of the game that Iran has been practicing. So it might not be that much logical to expect Iran to implement further, patience, considering the current situation.
A UN envoy calls on the US and the European Union to ease their sanctions on Venezuela, saying the measures have worsened the humanitarian situation in the country.
The economy's decline started in 2014 with the downturn in oil prices. Among other factors reported to affect the economy of Venezuela, unilateral sanctions increasingly imposed by the United States, the European Union, and other countries have exacerbated the above-mentioned challenges.
Dohan said the unilateral sanctions have had devastating effects on the basic human rights of Venezuelans, including the right to food, health, life, and education. She said the sanctions mainly affect those in extreme poverty. She called the existing humanitarian exceptions for Venezuela ineffective and insufficient. The UN envoy made the comments following a 12-day visit to the South American country. Venezuelan President Nicolas Maduro hailed the UN move and called the sanctions coercive.
Today, the rapporteur of the UN has called on the U.S. government and the governments of the European Union to review the sanctions and lift the sanctions against Venezuela because they have exacerbated this gigantic, enormous humanitarian crisis against the people.
Opposition leader Juan Guaido's UN envoy, on the other hand, criticized Duhan's remarks as imprecise and a propaganda tool. The United Nations had previously called on Washington to lift its sanctions on Venezuela during the COVID-19 pandemic. The U.S. ambassador to Caracas, however, claims the economic crisis in Venezuela is due to its government's corruption. Commentator David Barkin says it is unlikely that the U.S. softens Venezuela's sanctions regime as it has strong economic interests in the Latin American country.
Unfortunately, the Cold War notion of what's going on in Venezuela and the very, very strong economic interests of the United States and the desire on the part of U.S. Economic interests to take over the Venezuelan properties in the United States are militating against a softening of the regime in the United States with regard to Venezuela. I'm very pessimistic that Biden is going to make an about-face with regard to the sanctions regime in Venezuela.
Tensions are running high in Haiti as demonstrators have taken to the streets once again to protest against President Jovenel Moïse in the capital, Port-au-Prince. The protesters accused Moïse of illegally extending his term in office. A similar rally on Thursday turned violent after police fired tear gas on demonstrators. Tensions escalated after the president tried to force out three judges who were proposed as potential interim national leaders to replace him, including interim opposition leader Joseph Jean-Louis. Moïse argues that he was sworn into office for a five-year term in 2017 and that his tenure will end on February the 7th of next year. However, the opposition says Moïse's term expired 10 days ago, demanding he step down. The opposition stands accused of trying to kill the president and stage a coup against the government. The administration of U.S. President Joe Biden says it seeks to close the Guantanamo Bay prison by the end of its term. White House Press Secretary Jen Psaki says the closure of the notorious jail is, quote, certainly the administration's intention. Psaki says a process has been launched to examine steps towards this goal. Former President Barack Obama made a campaign promise in 2008 to shut down the detention facility, but failed to do so. His successor, Donald Trump, kept it open during his term. 40 inmates are still being held there for nearly two decades now, without charges or trial. The jail was set up following the 9/11 attacks in 2011 for foreign terror suspects. International human rights lawyer Edward Corrigan says Biden faces an uphill task to close Gitmo as U.S. security agencies see the jail as useful.
You have, you know, the Pentagon the State Department, immigration, many other departments that will push back and say, no, it's very useful. We don't want to close it. That's Barack Obama, after 8 years, failed to close Guantanamo Bay. So it is a very useful thing, but it's also abuse. You know, it's widespread torture, you know, detaining people without charge, without even evidence. And, you know, so Biden, if he can do it, that's great. It would remove a great embarrassment for the United States. But unfortunately, I think the Pentagon, the CIA, American Immigration, and others see it as a very, very useful tool. They don't have to provide any sort of legal rights to the detainees. So it'll be interesting to see if Biden can make true this promise. And we'll see if Guantanamo Bay, at least the security facilities, will in fact be closed down. But this is a great embarrassment, and it's a case where there's been widespread torture, waterboarding, and other things which have been held there that is much to the shame of the United States they allowed it.
Now, Brazil has registered over 51,500 additional confirmed cases of the novel coronavirus in 24 hours. Brazil's health ministry also reported nearly 1,300 more deaths from COVID-19 over the past day. According to official data, the country has so far registered more than 9.7 million infections since the pandemic began, with nearly 237,500 fatalities. Meanwhile, Mexico logged over 1,320 new deaths, raising the total to over 172,000. In the US, the total number of infections is nearing 27.5 million cases. The country, which remains the worst hit by the pandemic, has also reported over 480,000 deaths so far. Meanwhile, the World Health Organization says its mission to the Chinese city of Wuhan, where the COVID-19 outbreak first began, found leads on the contagion, though the source of the outbreak remains unclear.
Some of that work may lie outside the remit and scope of this mission. We have also said that this mission would not find all the answers, but it has added important information that takes us closer to understanding the origins of the virus.
The WHO chief said all the hypotheses on the origins of the pandemic remain on the table after the investigation in Wuhan. Earlier, the mission's head had rejected the theory that a leak from a virology lab in the Chinese city caused the outbreak. He said the lab incident is extremely unlikely, and it's not the hypothesis his team would suggest for future studies. The WHO team launched its probe in late January with the aim of establishing how the virus spread worldwide. Following its first outbreak in Wuhan in December 2019, the novel coronavirus has claimed the lives of over 2 million people across the globe. Senior US lawmakers have urged the UK to help end both countries' role in Saudi Arabia's war on Yemen. US Senator Ron Wyden told the British media that Washington's allies such as the UK and France should follow suit immediately and stop enabling the Saudi regime by selling weapons. Also, Senator Chris Murphy said that the respective economic benefits of offensive weapon sales to Riyadh do not outweigh the moral responsibility to end, quote, complicity in this ongoing nightmare. In his first speech on foreign policy, US President Joe Biden announced last week that Washington would end support for the Saudi-led offensive in Yemen, including relevant arms sales. Tens of thousands of Yemeni civilians have been killed in a Saudi-led war on the Arab countries since March 2015. Political commentator Faraz Al-Najm says the idea of ending the Saudi war on Yemen is a Western propaganda which has been going on for many years now.
You know, it's very quite clear that, I mean, the logistical support is being given and conducted by the American, British, and the French. They're the ones that tell them exactly where to strike, where to hit, and they're planning the whole war, pretty much. So, I mean, they can say that they're going to stop the arms deal, and they've said this before. They've said that they would put sanctions. They said they would stop the war. It's been going on for many years, right? This is a new president. And as we've seen other presidents from the same political party, such as Obama, drag on many things and find different ways to, build what he's trying to say. I mean, he says something, but he does the opposite. I think these type of promotions and propaganda is not going to be really implemented. We hope so. We pray so. We pray that other countries in the world stop arming Saudi Arabia, because this is the worst humanitarian crisis in the world. And we see the pictures of the famine and the children that are dying. And I don't think anywhere in the world they can tolerate such life or such scenarios. You know, I mean, how could we be living right now normally, knowing that there's people over there that are looking like skeleton bones, and kids that cannot even get the most basic medicines?
Now, the U.S. says the revocation of the terrorist designation of Yemen's Ansarullah movement becomes effective on February 16. U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken warned that despite the delisting, three of Ansarullah's leaders will remain subject to sanctions. Blinken said Washington will monitor the movement's activities and threatened its members with more sanctions. But a senior Yemeni official said the revocation proves that U.S. mistake in designating the movement in the first place and the legitimacy of Ansarullah's resistance against Saudi invaders. Former U.S. President Donald Trump blacklisted the movement only days before leaving office, prompting warnings from the UN and other world bodies of a large-scale famine in Yemen. The Biden administration says it will keep up the pressure on Ansarullah and continue to stand with Saudi Arabia in the face of attacks from the Yemeni side. Meanwhile, Yemenis have held a protest rally in front of the United Nations office in the capital Sana'a to condemn the continued detention of oil ships by the Saudi-led coalition amid international silence. Our correspondent in Sana'a, Abdul Latif Al-Washali, has more.
The U.S. detains oil ships is the slogans chanted by protesters in a rally held in front of the United Nations office in Sana'a. The protesters condemned the continued detention of oil ships by the Saudi-led coalition and demanded their release.
We hope that the new U.S. administration would lift the blockade on Yemen, but unfortunately it seems it is following the same policy. Not a single liter of oil derivatives has been released over the past weeks. The suffocating siege has deprived millions of Yemenis of fuel and deteriorated their life conditions.
The fuel crisis has deeply impacted the health sector of Yemen, as major hospitals like Thawra and Sana'a are on the verge of closure due to lack of fuel to provide health services.
Our health sector is negatively impacted by the siege. Some hospitals have stopped offering services due to lack of fuel. Intensive care rooms do not work any longer. The siege is targeting the lives of our nation. We call on the world to step in and put an end to this crisis.
12 Yemeni oil vessels are still detained by the Saudi-led coalition, contributing to the humanitarian crisis in Yemen that is on the brink of famine due to the Saudi-led war underway since 2015. Yemenis blame the United Nations for its inaction against the Saudi Arabia's illegal detention of oil ships. They say the UN inaction contributes to Yemen's deprivation of oil derivatives stored on the ships. Abdul Latif Al-Washali, Sana'a.
Turning to other news now, people in Myanmar continue their protests against the military putsch for an eighth straight day as anger rises over the arrests of coup opponents. The rallies have been held in several cities, including the business hub Yangon. The protests are in response to the recent arrest raids, some happening in the hours of darkness. According to the Assistance Association for Political Prisoners Monitoring Group, more than 320 people have been arrested since last week's coup. Meanwhile, the UN Human Rights Council adopted a resolution on Friday calling on Myanmar to release de facto leader Aung San Suu Kyi and other officials from detention. Demonstrators want the army to relinquish power and release civilian leaders, including Suu Kyi. The military seized power over the voter fraud allegations in November's elections that Suu Kyi's party won by a landslide. Massive inflation and unprecedented price hikes has triggered violent protests in the Pakistani capital. Javed Rana reports from Islamabad.
The clashes between the police and the government employees in Pakistan's capital, Islamabad. The security forces use excessive tear gas to prevent opposition-backed protesters who government fears could have besieged country's parliament. They demanded the government to raise their salaries by 40% to compensate them over massive price hike and inflation after Pakistan devalued its currency under an intense IMF pressure.
Tear gas and the Lathi charge, that is really shameful because we are not terrorists. Our salaries should be increased, should be competitive because when Imran Khan government took charge, inflation rate, you can see 300% inflation rate has been high and increased during the, the previous 2.5 years. And we are still, the PTI government has not increased even 1% our salaries in the last budget.
The protests by the government employees disrupted the usual official business across the country at a time when the mainstream opposition parties joined hands against Prime Minister Imran Khan's government to oust him from power over alleged rigging in 2018's general elections.
We condemn the brutal violence in government employees. It is incredible to see such excessive use of force against the government employees. If they do not work in their offices, the government business would come to a grinding half. Will Imran Khan alone run the government?
Fearing the politicization of the protest, a better sense prevailed, and Prime Minister Imran Khan's government apologized with the protesting employees of the government and finally successfully negotiated with the leaders of the employees' union to end their protest. The government has announced to increase a 25% raise in their salaries.
The troubles for the government are far from over. The mainstream opposition parties are all set to start a long march from all over Pakistan to capital Islamabad next month. However, with the end of the protest of employees, the government has managed to contain the crisis from being aggravated ahead of a long march. Javed Rana, Islamabad.
And with that report, we bring an end to our bulletin for this hour. Thank you for staying tuned.
Was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website www.parstoday.com/en.
Saturdays. In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful. Bismillah, words that seekers of sanctuary repeatedly recite. Words that the very cautious in search of protection often repeat. I seek refuge with Allah, the Exalted above all, from the oppression of the unjust, from the deceitful malice the envious use to lay snares and traps, from the injustice and outrage of the tyrants, and I sing his praise. Do better and go beyond other praisers. O Allah, thou art one, has no partner, and is the Lord Master without being made. There is no discrepancy or nonsense in thy commands, nor there is lawlessness in thy kingdom. I beseech thee to send blessings on Muhammad, thy servant, thy messenger. To let me ask thee for enlightenment and inspiration, so as to be thankful for thy bounties, which alone get thy approval ultimately. To help me to obey thee and instinctively worship thee, and make me deserve thy rewards on account of thy very patronage. And have mercy on me, and prevent me from breaking in the bounds of thy prohibitions, as far as I am kept alive, and show the way unto that which is useful and advantageous till I go on survive. To let me take to heart the meanings of thy book, and by its reading, throw down the heavy burden of sins, and receive welfare and salvation as a gift. Let not my family and friends who love me leave me alone. Let thy favors reach me in abundance during the remainder of my life, exactly as they used to be made available for me in full in the days gone by. O, the most merciful.
Nikki Haley, a former United Nations ambassador under President Donald Trump, who left the administration without the drama or ill will that marred most of its high-level departures, sharply criticized her former boss in an interview published on Friday, 12th of February, saying she was disgusted by his conduct on 6th of January, the day of the Capitol riot. The article you're about to hear has been written by the New York Times journalist Jeremy Peters. The piece is titled, Nikki Haley Slams Trump's Election Claims. We Shouldn't Have Followed Him. Stay with us for more of Jeremy Peters' article. Nikki Haley, a former United Nations ambassador under President Donald Trump, who left the administration without the drama or ill will that marred most of its high-level departures, sharply criticized her former boss in an interview published on Friday, 12th of February, saying she was disgusted by his conduct on 6th of January, the day of the Capitol riot. Nikki Haley, a 49-year-old who is widely believed to be considering a run for president in 2024, told the website Politico she did not believe that the former president would remain a dominant force within the Republican Party, or that he would seek office again, arguing that he had lost any sort of political viability. I don't think he's going to be in the picture, Ms. Haley said. I don't think he can. He's fallen so far. Ms. Haley's comments predictably prompted a backlash from Donald Trump's loyal base of support, a constituency that most Republican office holders continue to try to appease, and one that she had assiduously tried to avoid offending since leaving his administration at the end of 2018. Before her latest comments became public, Nikki Haley seemed to realize that they would go too far for many Republicans, and it was not long before she bowed to the reality of Mr. Trump's enduring power within the Republican Party. In an interview with Laura Ingraham of Fox News Channel that was broadcast late last month, after Ms. Haley had spoken to Politico but before the article was published, Ms. Haley muted her criticism of the former president considerably. At some point, I mean, give the man a break, she said, condemning Democrats for pursuing a second impeachment against Donald Trump for instigating the 6th of January assault on the Capitol. I mean, move on, she added. Does he deserve to be impeached? Absolutely not. But the storming of the Capitol building last month and Donald Trump's role in inciting it with repeated false claims of ballot rigging in last November's election caused Ms. Haley to reassess her relationship with the former president. Her tone changed markedly between interviews with Politico in December and in January. At first, she refused to acknowledge that Mr. Trump was doing anything reckless, by refusing to concede the election. She said that he genuinely believed he had not lost, and she would not acknowledge that his actions since the November election were irresponsible. And she wrongly predicted that Mr. Trump would go on his way once he had exhausted his legal options. But after the 6th of January riot, Nikki Haley told the publication that she had previously urged Mr. Trump to be more careful with his words, to no avail. He went down a path he shouldn't have done, she said, referring to his deception about the election, and we shouldn't have followed him, and we shouldn't have listened to him, and we can't let that ever happen again. In that moment, Nikki Haley's remarks showed that she was willing to entertain a political proposition that most other Republicans with eyes on the White House had not dared to utter publicly, that Donald Trump hold over the GOP base will loosen, and that he will not be the kingmaker that many have predicted. However calibrated or qualified, Nikki Haley's approach is a departure from that of other conservatives who are believed to harbor ambitions for higher office. Senator Josh Hawley of Missouri, who lent credibility to Donald Trump's voter fraud claims, has refused to acknowledge that his own actions played any role in inciting violence on 6th of January. And former Vice President Mike Pence has said nothing publicly since being forced to flee the Senate chamber under armed guard as rioters stormed the Capitol building, encouraged in part by Donald Trump's attacks against the Vice President on Twitter for not interfering with the certification of the election. Nikki Haley was specially pointed about Donald Trump's treatment of Mike Pence, sounding almost dismissive of the former president as she expressed her dismay. Mike Pence has been nothing but loyal to that man, she said. Some Republicans said that Ms. Haley's comments were simply acknowledging reality. As a politician who is more comfortable with the establishment wing of the GOP, she has not always had the trust of Donald Trump's base. And in a crowded 2024 presidential primary, she would face stiff competition from those votes. You didn't have to be clairvoyant to see which way Nikki Haley would go once Donald Trump lost, said Sam Nunberg, a consultant who worked for Mr. Trump. She was never going to be able to take the Trump mantle. To other Republicans, her words of regret were too little too late, given her earlier deference towards Donald Trump. Representative Adam Kinzinger of Illinois, who has become one of the most outspoken critics of his party since the Capitol attack, accused Nikki Haley of playing both sides. On Twitter, he urged her to pick country first or Trump first. This is not Nikki Haley's first reversal on Donald Trump. Like many leaders of her party, she initially opposed him when he ran for the Republican nomination in 2016. At that time, she was the governor of South Carolina, and she endorsed Senator Marco Rubio of Florida ahead of her state's pivotal primary. Donald Trump still won, finishing ahead of Marco Rubio by 10 percentage points. But she redeemed herself in the eyes of many Republican voters by signing on to work in the Trump administration, showing how quickly old slights can be forgiven by the former president and his supporters.
This is IRIB English Radio. Thank you. Our website is www.parstoday.com/en.
European News Bulletin.
Welcome back, everyone. I'm your host, Saeed Puruza. Straight to our top story. China has banned BBC World News from airing in the country. In a statement published at midnight Friday, China's National Radio and Television Administration criticized BBC reports for not being impartial and fair. China has defended its position, saying if the BBC chooses to be a rumor monger against China, it would have to bear the consequences. The news comes a week after UK media regulator Ofcom stripped Chinese state broadcaster CGTN of its British broadcast license. Ofcom accused the channel of breaching impartiality standards, an allegation China denies. For more on that, I'm joined by political analyst Carlos Martinez. Thank you for coming on. First off, your reaction to this recent flare-up of tensions between China and the UK.
Thanks, Saeed. So obviously, the immediate context to this is that CGTN's broadcast license was revoked by Ofcom last week, purportedly on the basis that CGTN is a state broadcaster and answerable to the Chinese government. Well, regardless of what view anyone takes about that rule, we can all see that it's being applied in a selective and discriminatory way. Lots of state broadcasters have Ofcom licenses, including the BBC, national broadcasters from Japan, France, South Korea, and so on. And I think Press TV can probably sympathize with this predicament, having itself been subjected to the same type of discrimination. So really, in revoking the BBC's license, the Chinese authorities are responding in kind, and I think the public sentiment in China.
Right, and what do you think of the Chinese comment? They have accused the BBC of being, and I quote, a rumor monger against Beijing.
Yeah, I think that's a perfectly accurate assessment. You know, BBC's coverage of China has been very biased, particularly in relation to Hong Kong, and particularly in relation to Xinjiang. For example, the BBC recently featured a very long expose article about human rights abuses being perpetrated against Uyghur Muslims in Xinjiang. But this expose was based almost exclusively on documents put together by some sources that have got basically no credibility whatsoever. First, there's Adrian Zenz, who's this sort of independent, far-right, anti-China crusader and a senior fellow at the Victims of Communism Memorial Foundation, whose research methods are dubious to say the least. And the other big source is the Australian Strategic Policy Institute, which is a government think tank funded by the US State Department, funded by various arms manufacturers. So China's well within its rights to complain about the BBC's lack of objectivity and credibility.
Other than the BBC's coverage of Hong Kong, if we were to go back and to look at what has led to this flare-up in tensions between the two sides, anything else that you can think of? Because they said they were going to hit the reset button in terms of their relations, especially in the post-Brexit world. What did go wrong?
Yeah, pressing the reset button would be a correct and necessary thing to do. And in terms of the interests of the British people and in terms of humanity as a whole, in terms of the wider context of the new Cold War, would be a very sensible thing. Unfortunately, tensions between the UK and China have only ramped up over the last year or two. Obviously, in the last few weeks, we've had the dispatch of British Navy warships to the South China Sea in a clear statement of support for NATO and the US's China encirclement strategy, which is in itself an irresponsible and hostile act and a threat to peace. And I wonder what the British public's response would be if Chinese warships were to enter British waters. I suspect not very favorable. Meanwhile, a few months ago, you had Britain essentially taking orders from Mike Pompeo to remove Huawei from Britain's 5G infrastructure on spurious security grounds. And then, of course, we've got the interference in China's internal affairs by offering residency to Hong Kong's BNO passport holders, which is essentially making a statement in support of an anti-China separatist movement in Hong Kong, which itself, up till 1997, was a British colony run on more or less apartheid and highly anti-democratic lines. So, we've got a state of tensions which is escalating, right. And it would be very wise for the British authorities to, as you put it, hit that reset button.
All right. Carlos Martinez, political analyst. Thanks for your input. Moving on now. At least 20 Israelis, including individuals from the weapons industry, are under investigation over illegal weapons sales to an unspecified Asian country. Israeli officials say the suspects developed, manufactured, tested, and sold suicide drones, also known as kamikaze drones, to the unnamed country. The news comes less than 2 weeks after the announcement of 3 sales of these kinds of weapons by the Israeli arms industry to unnamed Asian countries. Russia's UN delegation has clashed with Western ambassadors at a virtual meeting of the world body in New York.
Over the last 6 years, we've had 2 very important questions which Kiev still hasn't answered. How exactly do they intend to resolve the conflict? And how do they envisage the future special status of the Donbas region within Ukraine?
The United States reaffirms its unwavering commitment to Ukraine's sovereignty and territorial integrity. We will never recognize Russia's attempted annexation of Crimea.
Kiev's began its use of force shelling residential areas by its army, which continues to this day. How can the people of Donbas have any connection with Ukraine?
The people of Crimea voted to rejoin Russia in a referendum in 2014. Kiev ignored the decision and sent in troops, leading to clashes with Russian-backed separatists. So far, more than 14,000 people have been killed in the conflict. Russia says it's prepared to break off relations with the European Union if the bloc imposes any more sanctions on Moscow. The UK and EU have introduced targeted sanctions on Russia over Alexei Navalny, the country's leading far-right opposition figure. The EU is now considering additional measures over his recent jail sentence, a move lauded by Navalny's allies.
Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov has made it very clear Russia will not tolerate the UK and EU interfering in its internal affairs. A week after Moscow expelled diplomats from Sweden, Poland and Germany, accusing them of attending a rally in support of opposition figure Alexei Navalny, Lavrov warned against any further provocations.
We do not want to isolate ourselves from the world, but we must be ready for this. If you want peace, prepare for war.
Navalny recently returned to Russia from Berlin, where he was recovering from a nerve gas poisoning. Accused of violating the terms of his parole in an embezzlement case dating back to 2014, he was arrested upon arrival and handed a 2.5-year jail sentence. And now he is in court again, facing charges of slandering a war veteran who appeared in a clip broadcast on Russia Today. It promoted constitutional reforms which would extend President Vladimir Putin's rule. In a tweet, Navalny branded the war veteran and the others in the clip traitors, but he himself is now facing the same accusation. His allies are urging the EU to impose fresh sanctions on Moscow, which the Kremlin says is nothing less than betrayal.
the only plausible explanation for Navalny actually turning on the Russian establishment is that he's basically a paid operative. I mean, we've seen this time and time again. Juan Guaido in Venezuela is one example. We've seen even the Green movement in Iran arguably is possibly another example of it. But of course, the Western governments have a habit of creating false flags, psychological operations, color revolutions. This is part of the permanent goodie bag and package that comes with Western foreign policies. So Russia is no different.
The bloc's foreign ministers will debate possible sanctions against the Kremlin on February 22nd. France and Germany are pushing for travel bans and asset freezes on Putin's allies, possibly as soon as this month. Bianca Rahimi, London.
Moving away from Russia now, millions continue to celebrate the measures implemented by U.S. President Joe Biden. But there is one promise Joe Biden has yet to fulfill, directly tied to criticisms of past policies he pioneered. Will Joe Biden keep his word to Black America? Richard Sedan raises that question in this edition of Cut to the Chase.
With the world still reveling at the removal of Donald Trump from the White House, people have been celebrating the election of President Joe Biden. Since the election race began, the Democrats and the liberal media attempted to present Biden as a decent-minded, all-American libertarian sent down from on high to cure Americans' wounded divides. But is this really the case? Well, in the interest of fairness, it's only right to look at his early actions since taking office and his record as a senator. Let's take a look. In his first few hours in office, Joe Biden immediately signed a number of executive orders taking action on a range of issues. They included reversing Trump's Muslim travel ban, halting plans for the controversial Keystone oil pipeline, allowing transgender people to join the US military, stopping the Mexican border wall construction, rejoining the Paris Climate Agreement, taking action over the coronavirus pandemic, which under Donald Trump spiraled out of control. These measures and the selection of former Attorney General Kamala Harris as Biden's vice president led liberals around the world to hail Biden as a progressive, woke president of the people. However, despite this, there are critical issues and promises glaringly absent from Joe Biden's magic bucket list of early executive orders. And what's missing from the list has been completely drowned out in the wave of uncritical support for Biden. Because many people want to forget that during his decades-long career, Joe Biden consistently pushed policies and rhetoric that devastated Black American communities. Joe Biden's 94 crime bill, something which the liberal media have remained quiet on, is widely viewed as paving the way for mass incarceration in the United States, mass incarceration which overwhelmingly impacts Black people. Not only that, but the language used by Biden in pushing the bill through was remarkably similar to the racially charged super predator myth pushed by the Clintons, who wanted to play up to racial stereotypes about Black people.
We have finally gotten more police officers on the street. That was one of the goals that the president had when he pushed the crime bill that was passed in 1994.
Yes, that crime bill signed by Hillary's husband, Bill, with none other than Joe Biden standing behind him, clapping for a bill which would send thousands of Black people unjustly to prison. Now, back to the all-American racist language that made the crime bill possible.
They are not just gangs of kids anymore. They are often the kinds of kids that are called super predators.
Super predators? Did she mean? No, she meant. And everyone knows this is the cunning racist language of the post-Reagan era. Now, back to President Biden. Surely Biden didn't play this game too, did he?
It doesn't matter whether or not they're the victims of society. The end result is they're about to knock my mother on the head with a lead pipe, shoot my sister, beat up my wife, take on my sons. So I don't want to ask, what made them do this? They must be taken off the street. That's number one. There's a consensus on that. Unless we do something about that cadre of young people, tens of thousands of them, born out of wedlock, without parents, without supervision, without any structure, without any conscience developing, because they literally, I yield myself three more minutes, because they literally have not been socialized.
Born out of wedlock, without parents, without supervision, and without conscience. Who exactly is Biden stereotyping here, and which audience is he playing to? Still, maybe we're wrong. Biden can't be racist. After all, he did select Kamala Harris as his vice president. And a long time has passed since 1994. It's not like he's made any racist statements since then, surely.
Unlike the African-American community, with notable exceptions, the Latino community is an incredibly diverse community with incredibly different attitudes about different things.
Wait, so all black Americans think in the same way? Well, all right, maybe that was a slip of the tongue by President Biden. Surely, especially in the election campaign, Biden wouldn't make any more sweeping generalizations about black people, right?
It's a long way until November. We got more questions.
You got more questions, but I tell you, if you have a problem figuring out whether you're for me or Trump, then you ain't black.
Well, all right, so maybe he did. But at least despite these comments, Biden has now begun to make amends to reform the system he created, right? Wrong. According to activists, reducing the footprint of federal prisons will not reduce mass incarceration in any significant way. It will simply push prisoners to public prisons. It will do nothing to end the systematic injustice which sees black people imprisoned in disproportionately higher numbers for crimes which others are not, in what is now known as a modern form of slavery. Joe Biden made a promise when he was elected.
Especially those moments, and especially those moments when this campaign was at its lowest ebb, the African-American community stood up again for me.
But given his track record, do we really expect Biden to change? So many other communities have seen their concerns prioritized by Biden, and as of yet, he has taken no serious action on policing or mass incarceration. Has Biden really changed? Or is he the same Biden who pushed through the 94 crime bill?
Portugal's parliament has voted to extend the country's state of emergency to the beginning of March, allowing the government to keep the current national lockdown in place for the rest of this month.
It's all very clear. We must leave spring without another summer and autumn under threat in terms of lives, health, economy and society. We must ensure that Easter in early April won't be a cause for more months similar to the past weeks.
When the COVID-19 pandemic reached Europe, Portugal was praised for its swift reaction, while other countries were overwhelmed. Now it's the world's worst per capita rate of coronavirus cases and deaths. With its health service overwhelmed, the desperate nation has asked Germany for medical help. By Sunday last week, only 7 intensive care beds had been left in the entire country.
This is European News Bulletin broadcast by IRIB English Radio. In this program, we cover the most recent developments all over Europe. You can listen to this program on Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, and Saturday.
In this segment, the comments by Kehinde Andrews, a black studies professor, who says the UK was built on racism and compared Winston Churchill to Hitler. Let's see how those comments have gone down in this country with Richard Sudan. Richard, take it away.
Absolutely, Saeed, and good to see you. So there's been a massive debate which has erupted online concerning Winston Churchill, which is dubbed, or who is dubbed rather, as Britain's greatest ever Briton. But I think here the reality for many is if you're born in Britain and you're educated in Britain like I was, you would have had a very one-sided view of history and Churchill when you went to school. but I think the more kind of serious intellectual, internationalist, scholarly view put forward by Mr. Kehinde Andrews really understands that Britain's legacy has a much different reputation around the world than it does in Britain, because, of course, Britain colonized and committed genocide in Africa, Asia, all around the world, and actually much of that colonization and genocide was predicated on the idea that white Europeans are of a superior race. And Churchill himself actually talked about this idea himself. It's on the historical record that he believed white people were a superior race. This is a matter of historical fact, and facts simply don't care about people's feelings. You know, why would we not listen to the historical views from Professor Kehinde Andrews compared to, say, the likes of the Daily Mail, which platforms people, or did platform people, like Katie Hopkins, etc., etc.? I think the truth about Britain is what it is, and if you want to glorify Churchill, Britain and the Empire, and Britannia ruling the waves, you have to really acknowledge the whole picture.
All right, and then what I find fascinating is when he appears on British television, he constantly gets interrupted, and they won't even let him finish his sentence. Probably, lends a lot of support to the veracity of the arguments that he's bringing. Maybe tell us what Twitter users have been saying about the professor and what he's been saying.
So let's go to Decolonize the Curriculum, that says, Galton's eugenics, we know Churchill firmly believed in the ideology, and of course he did. Nessa tweets to say, Britain as a nation oppressed, and pressed the messed up island for centuries, isn't racist. Churchill had almost the same views as Hitler. What about him is worthy of praise. Churchill was responsible for genocide too. And we have an interesting reaction here, and a telling one, from Nigel Farage. Farage tweeted, a woke school has banned Winston Churchill because he promoted racism and inequality. Apparently he also unfairly imprisoned and tortured many. This rewriting of history in our education system is dangerous. I highlighted this because many would say, Saeed, Farage is a proto-fascist or certainly a racist. Many would say he led a very racist campaign, so perhaps it's not surprising that Nigel Farage would endorse the factual racism of Winston Churchill.
All right, Richard, and while we're still talking about racism, tell us what the British Home Secretary has been saying about the Black Lives Matter protests against racial injustice in 2020.
Oh, shock, horror, hold on to your seat. Priti Patel labeled Black Lives Matter as, quote, dreadful. But to me, Saeed, this didn't really surprise me, because we learned from the Windrush scandal that Priti Patel already evidently doesn't believe that Black Lives Matter, because that scandal directly impacted communities, almost exclusively black, dealing with major injustices, wrongful, unlawful deportations, in some instances leading to death. And Priti Patel has done nothing to implement the findings of the Windrush review by Wendy Williams, despite the fact she promised she would. But also, one more quick point, Saeed. I think Priti Patel may have aspirations to be Prime Minister. Boris Johnson is on the record as calling black people pickaninnies with watermelon smiles. So maybe Priti Patel wants to appeal to Boris Johnson's voter base in order to have political aspirations. That's what some people are saying, Saeed.
Wow. Well, let's hear some other people's view on this as well.
I want to go to Joe Plumstead first, who says, Priti Patel hits out at the dreadful Black Lives Matter protest. What an awful human being. I'm so sick of this level of ignorance. Tom tweets, Patel playing the populist, nationalist, xenophobic card again. Racist lapid wrapped in a union flag. Covert support for the ultra-nationalist, xenophobes or worse. And finally, if we have time, Diane Abbott MP tweeted, so the Home Secretary continues in her mission to bring communities together. A very tongue-in-cheek, sarcastic tweet there from Diane Abbott.
And she is definitely not woke, Richard, is she?
I think many would say, Saeed, she's the polar opposite and perhaps antithesis of woke. And I mean, to come out with a statement like this, to back up many of her policies. To be fair to Patel, many of these scandals erupted before her tenure, but many would also say she certainly perpetuated racist policies and arguably made it worse since her time as Home Secretary.
All right, Richard Sedam with those stories. Richard, thank you so much. And thank you, everyone. Goodbye for now.
the limelight.
Samer Arbit's case is just the latest example of Israeli regime forces going unpunished for vicious human rights abuses, says Tal Steiner, the executive director of the Public Committee Against Torture, in an article published under the heading, Torture of Palestinian Prisoners, Time to End Israeli Regime's Impunity. Stay tuned, please, for the details of this article. On September 25, 2019, a Palestinian man was arrested by Israeli regime troops and transferred to the compound detention facility in Al-Quds for interrogation by Israeli regime's internal intelligence agency, the Shin Bet. Samer Arbit's arrest marked the beginning of a wave of arrests in the ensuing month throughout the occupied West Bank. Later, media publications would describe this operation as a crackdown on the Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine. For 2 days after his arrest, Arbit, who had been otherwise healthy at the time of his arrest, was brought to Al-Quds Harassa Hospital in critical condition, suffering from kidney failure and broken ribs. He was placed on a respirator until his condition stabilized, and then, to the shame of the military court that approved it, sent back to the custody of the Shin Bet.